and enjoy it. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Officers and formally censured three others for their involvement in the deadly drone strike on an aid convoy that killed people in Gaza on Monday. The IDF said the drone operators had mistaken an aid worker in a World Central Kitchen van for a gunman. There have been widespread calls for an independent probe into the killings. World Central Kitchen said Israel could not credibly investigate its own failure in Gaza. Speaking from Brussels, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged Israel to put human lives first.
As Israel pursues any military operations against Hamas, it has to prioritize the protection of civilians. It has to make that job number one. Too many people have been caught in this crossfire of Hamas's making. Children, women, men, losing their lives. Their safety has to be a priority, and military operations need to be designed around their protection, not the other way around.
The leader of the Iran-backed Hezbollah group in Lebanon has said Tehran will retaliate after a strike widely blamed on Israel killed seven members of the Revolutionary Guards in Syria on Monday. Hassan Nasrallah warned that Iran's response to the targeting of its commanders was inevitable. The World Food Programme says it's completed its first delivery of aid to the Darfur region of Sudan since February. The situation in one of the areas worst affected by the conflict between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary RSF is reported to be dire, with almost 25 million people in need of assistance. The WFP convoy from neighbouring Chad carried enough food for only 1% of that total. WFP's Chad country director, Pierre Honorat, said it's critical that additional help comes into Sudan.
Humanitarian corridors are a must. Many people are suffering in Darfur today, and we don't want more people to come to Chad. So we really need to assist them where they are today. It's urgent. We need to continue our cargo, our shipments. We've done a lot already since last year, but we need to do much more.
An Austrian mountaineering organisation has warned that the country risks becoming largely ice-free within 45 years. Here's Bethany Bell.
The Austrian Alpine Club said 2023 was exceptionally unfavourable for glaciers. On average, they shrank by 23 metres. The report says heat waves and dry conditions over the past couple of years mean glaciers have been unable to regenerate. The most badly affected glacier was the Pastelza in the southern province of Carinthia, which shrank by almost 203 metres, a new record. The Alpine Club strongly warned against expanding ski resorts into glacier regions. It said Austria's winter tourism industry needed environmentally friendly policies.
World News from the BBC. The southern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia has come under a massive, deadly Russian rocket attack. The governor, Ivan Fyodorov, says at least three high-rise blocks and 10 private homes were damaged. Three people were killed, 13 wounded, four of them seriously. The governor said two missiles struck first, and then, after rescuers and police arrived, three more hit. Thousands of people have marched in the Bosnian capital Sarajevo along the route of a striking new memorial on the anniversary of the start of the bloody siege of the city. The Path of Remembrance consists of 11,541 donated pairs of shoes, one pair for each person killed during the siege perpetrated by Bosnian Serb forces, which lasted almost 4 years, starting in April 1992. A magnitude 4.8 earthquake has hit the US state of New Jersey, rattling buildings in nearby New York City and prompting the temporary pausing of a UN Security Council meeting on Gaza. There are currently no reports of major damage, but the White House said President Biden had been briefed. Michelle Fleury reports.
Surprised residents reported shaking buildings from New Jersey to New York, Pennsylvania and Connecticut. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the epicenter was near its White House station in New Jersey, prompting the state's governor, Phil Murphy, to activate its Emergency Operations Center. Two airports, JFK and Newark, were all put on ground stop while runways were being inspected for damage. New York City's buses and trains are all operating as normal.
The president of the French Professional Cyclists Union has called for the sport to be made safer after a spate of high-speed crashes. Three of the world's top cyclists have been hospitalised in the past week, including the current Tour de France champion Jonas Vingegaard, who suffered a collapsed lung and broken ribs and collarbone on Thursday. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinor. Our topic today is war, and in about 15 minutes we'll have what I expect to be fascinating discussion with three guests who are here in our brand new studio. Not the studio itself, but everything in it. But we are starting today with Christopher Gunness from London. He is a former spokesperson for UNRWA, and we'll be talking with him about the current war, if that's what it is, in Gaza. Hello, Chris. Thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Esti. Nice to be with you, and hello to all your listeners.
Yeah, and really appreciate you joining us on a Friday evening for you. Of course, 2 days ago, 3 days ago, seven international aid workers in Gaza were killed, which started an international outrage, even though they are just seven of about 200 aid workers that have been killed so far, among many, many more. What were you thinking when you heard about that?
Well, to be honest, I was not surprised, but I was appalled. I was appalled because here are aid workers. The Israeli army had been told of the exact GPS coordinates of the route they were traveling on. The three vehicles concerned had been what they call coordinated with the Israeli army. That means that they notified the number plates of the vehicles, the types of the vehicles. They said they were clearly marked, which they were, with the very brightly colored logo of World Central Kitchens, and the Israelis had the names of all the people inside the vehicles. And what happened is the first one was struck, and immediately they called the Israeli army and said, "You've just killed some international aid workers." But they evacuated the first vehicle in the three-vehicle convoy into the second vehicle, and then the second vehicle was hit. So all of those who were either wounded or just about alive or who could get to the third vehicle went to the third vehicle. And lo and behold, not long afterwards, the third vehicle was struck. So what we had was what appears to be deliberate targeting. Now, I understand that in the last few hours, the Israeli army has said that it was a tragic mistake. But What the world was promised after this outrage was an independent investigation. And I do not consider an investigation by the Israeli army into alleged war crimes by the Israeli army to be an independent and credible investigation, which is why it's such a shame that the Americans have announced in the last few minutes that they would not be having their own independent investigation. I think the families of those who were killed should be outraged by this, because that's not what I call justice, and neither do I call justice the fact that the Israeli army has announced that a handful of officers have been dismissed. If that's what you get for committing what's effectively a murder, I don't think that's going to look like justice as far as the families of those who were killed is concerned. So a wholly inadequate response by the Israeli army, and I hope that the countries of those nationals who were killed and the families themselves kick up a real fuss about this, because it's not good enough. What we want is an independent, thorough and transparent investigation.
Yeah, so I was listening this morning to National Public Radio when they talked about it, and heard some apologetics for what happened, and the notion, as you said, that it was a mistake, and of course mistakes happen, but considering the general situation in Gaza and the efficiency with which Israel has so far killed and destroyed and made sure that Palestinians not have medical care, not have food, not have water, not have infrastructure, etc. I wonder, and I wonder if you were thinking about that too. To me, it seems like it probably was definitely something that was planned so that aid organizations stop their operations and the famine in Gaza is sure to kill more people. Do you think I'm like out of order here?
Well, I certainly think that the starting point for this, and no doubt it was your starting point also, Esty, has got to be the International Court of Justice, the highest court on our planet, which has ruled on the 26th of January that there is a plausible case of genocide to answer. And the court was very clear that part of that genocidal action is the destruction of the means of life and livelihood. So we've seen food production plants completely destroyed. We've seen agricultural land completely destroyed. We've seen the roads along which aid is meant to travel completely destroyed. We've seen the food warehouses and the food distribution centers damaged and in some cases destroyed. And we've seen 176 members of United Nations Relief and Works Agency, that I used to be the spokesman for, killed, and in all, 200 aid workers have died. In addition, we've seen every university in Gaza completely destroyed, and we've seen the killing of over 10,000 women and children. Now, in the recent days, there's been much reporting on the AI, the Lavender AI system, which the Israeli army is using. And according to sources within the Israeli army, this has allowed people to be tracked, so-called militants, tracked into their homes. And then when they're with their families, the homes are then destroyed. And it seems extraordinary to me that there is a policy, a machine, an AI platform, call it whatever you will, that has been programmed in order to allow indiscriminate and disproportionate and quite deliberate attacks. Now, if that isn't the definition of a war crime, I don't know what is. And to answer your question more specifically, under the Rome Statute, which set up the International Criminal Court, it is illegal, it is a crime to use food as a weapon of war. And what has Israel, what had Israel done until just, you know, a few hours ago? Pretty much all of the crossings were completely restricted. Before the war, 500 trucks a day were getting in for UNRWA alone. And since then, it's about 100, around 200 on one very good day. But essentially, there are hundreds of trucks lined up at the Rafah crossing on the border between Gaza and Egypt. And Israel on certain days is letting in none whatsoever, and almost none at all to the north, none from UNRWA to the north since the 22nd of March. So yes, I think there is a policy of starvation, of mass famine, partly because we've had the Israeli defense minister, Yoav Gallant, saying that there will be a total blockade, no food, no water, no medicine, no fuel, but also on the ground. That's what we've seen. So we've got the rhetoric, which expresses intentionality, the intention to commit mass starvation. And then you have on the ground, very, very few trucks going in, and aid organizations reporting that hundreds of thousands of people today are facing starvation. And the UK charity Save the Children has said that 23 children have actually starved to death, and the figure is probably far higher. So no, I don't think it's fanciful to say that starvation is being deliberately inflicted, that food is being used as a weapon of war. It is a war crime, and those responsible, including Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, must be held accountable. In the case of Putin, the ICC issued an arrest warrant, and the ICC has been investigating crimes, human rights crimes committed by the IDF, and I hope that very soon we're going to see arrest warrants issued for the likes of Mr. Netanyahu, the prime minister, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister. And of course, let's not forget Yitzhak Herzog, who is the president of Israel, who in the first couple of weeks of this war said that it was impossible to distinguish ordinary civilians from terrorists. In other words, they're all targets. So let us hope that the ICC will issue arrest warrants and we can move towards accountability, because there's no doubt in my mind that a combination of an arms embargo against Israel, cutting off weapons supplies to Israel, and to be clear, the United States supplies $3.8 billion of weapons or military aid to Israel a year. But there also needs to be accountability in the form of arrest warrants issued against those who've expressly made statements expressing genocidal intent.
Mm-hmm. And the UN Human Rights Committee just agreed that Israel, that there are grounds to take Israel to court for war crimes, but and I have so much more to ask you, Chris, but we have very little time. So my question is, what about the United States? It is the United States that is enabling it, that is providing the weapons, that has been protecting Israel in the UN and everywhere else. What about this country?
Well, that's a very good question. And what we've seen in the first 5.5 months of this war is not just America providing economic and military support in, as I say, the form of $3.8 billion a year of military aid. But we've also seen diplomatic and political support. So for many months in the Security Council, every time a ceasefire resolution came up, the United States ambassador at the United Nations vetoed it until very, very recently. So you not just get the material support, you get the economic and the political support. Now, after the killing of the 7 aid workers and the international revulsion, the huge groundswell of revulsion that engulfed the Biden administration, you've now got an announcement, hey presto, that Israel is allowing food aid. They're opening up the northern crossing point, the Erez crossing, and they've announced that they're allowing in far more aid. Now, that just shows that America, if it wants to, can use its influence on Israel, and that influence works. So, you know, let us not buy into this, the Biden administration can't bring pressure. It can, and that decision today by Israel to allow in much more aid just shows how complicit the US was prior to this decision in allowing Israel to commit a plausible genocide, to use the phrase of the ICJ, and with the United States was complicit in inflicting mass starvation. And to be clear, mass starvation is a slow motion massacre. If children are starving today, which they are, they need nutrients, they need medicine, they need medical care, they need hospitals, they need nurses, they need their mothers, they need all sorts of things. And just opening up the crossings and allowing a few more trucks in is not going to stop mass starvation killing people. And frankly, the United States is complicit in those deaths.
Well, Christopher Gunness, former spokesperson for UNRWA, I hope we can speak again sometime soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Bye. And We'll move in straight to our panel here in the studio. With us is Mark Silbermann, Professor Emeritus of German and a Brecht scholar who has translated and edited many works on Brecht and German culture. Also with us is Nam Kim, Associate Professor of Anthropology and co-author of Emergent Warfare in Our Evolutionary Past, on obviously the origins of warfare. He is personally a child of war himself, as his father is Korean and met his Vietnamese mother during the Vietnam War. They left in the exodus of 1975. And the third person with us is David Simmons, the founder and director of Filmat's Last Theater Company, started in 2013. And Fermat does primarily documentary theater that confronts issues of political and social inequality. It's a free theater that never charges admission for its work. Thank you all for joining us today. And I would like to start with you, Nam, and I would like to also introduce myself in a different way than usual. I'm also a daughter of war. My father is a Holocaust survivor. My mother survived the Nazi blitz on Germany. My father, who was a historian of the Holocaust, wrote a couple books. I grew up among people with numbers tattooed on their forearms, and the big question, how could that happen? How could the whole world see what was going on and not intervene until, 6 million Jews died and so many other millions of non-Jews? And I think that question is still very pertinent for me and for the world, even more so now, because we really are watching everything in real time. And it goes on. And, again, I'll go back to public radio because this is the most mainstream I check out. I don't really tune into CNN and so on. But it's all okay. What's going on in Ukraine is totally not okay. What's going on in Palestine, which is so much worse, is okay. So I just wonder about your musings, your thoughts, listening to Christopher Gunness and generally speaking, what's going on right now. As someone who studied war.
Right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Esti. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you for sharing about your background and positionality as well. These very sobering topics have been with me and my family for generations. I should not even be here if it not had been for Cold War political machinations that brought two people together in a part of the world where they under normal circumstances never would have met each other. And then, of course, flight from conflict that displaced my father from his homeland, from my mother from hers, also displaced the three of us once again in 1975. So these are questions I've been exploring for a very long time, inspired by our own personal family history. It originally led me to ask questions about the current world, but to think about war, and as you very eloquently stated, how is it that we allow it to be okay? I think it stems from some perspectives about whether or not war is inevitable, whether or not it's biologically ingrained within us as a species, whether or not it has propelled us with some kind of propensity towards violence over the course of human evolution. There are those arguments that are out there. They've been out there for quite some time, and it goes back to debates centuries ago, probably millennia ago, these Hobbesian versus Rousseauian views about the human past. It kind of inspired me not only to look at the modern world, but then to ask that question, well, how far back do we see these kinds of activities? And are they in fact a part of us biologically? The simple answer is we don't know for sure. However, you asked for my musings. I'll give you some. as an anthropologist who dabbles in various subfields, different kinds of data sets, as an archaeologist who looks deeper into the past, peering into that rabbit hole that I've been peering into for some time now has shown that warfare does go very far back in time. There's no question about that. Depending on one's definition of war, depending on one's view, whether or not this is a relatively recent phenomenon, historically speaking, is it tied to state-level societies? Is it tied to farming and sedentism? Or does it go further back in time? There are all kinds of opinions about this, but the archaeological record shows that even before there were states, even before cities and sedentism and farming, people were fighting. We see evidence, archaeologically speaking, of organized violence between groups of people. It's in the artifacts. It's on the remains of humans and the fossils. It's in the landscape. But once we start getting into the deeper past, in terms of whether or not it is something that's evolved from our deepest ancestors, we can talk about anatomically modern humans over the last 200,000 to 300,000 years, or even our Homo archaic ancestors going back millions of years. Those Pleistocene contexts are very murky and fragmentary. And so people have turned to other analogs to try to answer those questions. And some of them come up with windows into that past, such as chimpanzee behavior or other kinds of analogs. That information, I think, is very, very patchy and hazy, but people push the bounds of the data and make these conclusions about, yes, we have been very violent for a very long time, but I personally don't see it that way.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think, especially even if it's true that from the dawn of humanity we were fighting, we are presumably a lot more sophisticated nowadays. We are presumably quite more intelligent, or I don't know if intelligent is the right word, but more advanced. How come we can create such advanced weapons, but we cannot come with a way not to fight?
So I think I would be very careful in the way I look at things in terms of sophisticated or advanced. We are humans. We've been humans for a very long time. However, our technologies may change, but the ways in which we interact with each other, our views of the world, I don't really like to have a kind of subjective view about what is more advanced versus another. Our ancestors viewed the world in their own way. In terms of conflict, if we accept a different premise, that conflict is not really primitive or advanced, it stems from human sociality. It stems from cooperation. Sometimes people make a kind of distinction between cooperation and competition, war and competition or cooperation. But the way I and my colleague, Mark Kissel, the co-author of this monograph, the way that we look at this question is, at what point do humans become very capable of not only certain kinds of cognition, symbolic thinking, but also forms of cooperation? Once we start becoming like that, it opened the door for all kinds of complex behaviors where we work in groups for common goals. Those goals sometimes can become very violent and they can be directed at other groups, or they can be the opposite. They can help us to come up with very creative solutions to avoid conflict. Looking at the question from that perspective offers me a bit more hope in that we're not doomed to these kinds of decisions. We've just learned to advance these decisions in the current settings that we are in, but we're not always faced with the same exact conditions that force us down those pathways. We can be very creative in our imagination and our will to avoid these kinds of situations.
Yeah, we can, but we don't.
Not always.
Yeah, not definitely not now. Yes. But well, speaking of advanced cognition, Bertolt Brecht was quite an advanced cognitive person. Human, in my opinion. And we actually planned this panel a while ago because Fermat is going to present Mother Courage. Oh, is that how you say it? Is it courage or courage?
Courage.
It is courage, Mother Courage, by Bertolt Brecht. So let me ask you, Mark Silberman, for those among our listeners who are not familiar, who was Bertolt Brecht, and Yeah, talk a little about Mother Courage.
Thank you, Esti, and thank you for inviting us here to talk about this topic. First of all, I'd like to say I think Brecht is, especially with this play, but also in others, is a good example of how to use art as a weapon of war, that is, to throw light onto some of the very things that Nam was just talking about. And it's interesting to note as well that this play, Mutter Courage, as it's called in German, Mother Courage, is a play that at the moment is one of the most performed plays internationally of Brecht. And it often becomes the play that is put on most by Brecht during times of war. So this play has become a touchstone again and again about the relationship of individuals to these social factors in times of war, trying to raise questions about how we then, as the audience in our particular time, might think about war. So very briefly, Bertolt Brecht is a German author. He was born in 1898. He went into exile in 1933 when the Nazis came into power. He gradually moved north to Denmark, to Sweden, to Finland, finally coming to the United States as a refugee in 1941, and then he left very abruptly in 1947 after testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and settled first of all in Switzerland and then was offered a theater in East Berlin in the Soviet occupied zone and moved there in 1948, just as East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, was founded. He died relatively briefly after that in 1956 as one of the most celebrated dramatists from Germany. Mm-hmm. So that's briefly.
Well, Brecht. And while here he was followed by this the FBI, correct?
Oh, yes. He has a file which is available online from the FBI. One can read about how he was spied on.
And that's because he was anti-war, he was socialist.
Suspected of being a communist, of being a member of the Communist Party, and that's why they were particularly interested in him. He never was a card-carrying communist. He was certainly a fellow traveler, but he had his problems with Stalin, with communism in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, with the various, just for this context, I would say with the regimes that were into war.
Yes. I might
on their people and on the rest of the world.
Yes. I might point out also that this play is an unusual play by Brecht because he wrote it in 6 weeks. Most of Brecht's plays are available in multiple versions because he kept tinkering with them. But this play he wrote immediately after the war began in 1939 when Germany overran Poland. He had fled to Denmark immediately, and he was under pressure to leave then Denmark, go to Sweden, and he wrote this play to be put on in Sweden, which it wasn't, because he was hoping that Sweden, being one of the northern countries, this play being set in the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, where Sweden and Norway were involved, that maybe this would be a play that would have some impact in the Scandinavian mm-hmm. countries.
And I think Norway didn't even exist then, right?
It didn't.
Norway was crafted right. out of Sweden.
Sweden, yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Well, David, you are the founder and director of Fermat's Last Theater. Why did you choose to stage Mother Courage? And what is the play about?
The play is about war. Mother Courage is a small-scale war profiteer, and she sells goods to whichever side can pay. She has three children, which she tries to protect, but it doesn't work out well. The work that we're staging is a fairly radical adaptation, Mother Courage Alone. The original play has 26 characters and runs about 3.5 hours. So we've reduced it down to one actress, one narrator, and a single musician. But I think that the essence of the play is still very much there. And we see Mother Courage trying to negotiate her way in times of war and survive and make money, but it does not end well for her.
Yeah. So while profiteering, back to you, Nam, in a sense, I mean, this is what Mother Courage is about, but like David just said, she's basically trying to survive, right? She's trying to feed her kids. So I read fairly recently a book, an African book. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was titled. But anyway, one of the characters there is also a war profiteer. But by being a war profiteer, he actually brings food into a place that doesn't have food. So that's one way of war profiteering. But I think that when we talk about war and why we have it, war profiteering seems to be a huge part of it, especially nowadays when you think about, for example, the $18 billion package that Biden is trying to pass in the Congress just for Israel. And then there's Ukraine, and then there's Taiwan, and then there's all the other places that, you know, you don't hear about in the news. That's an awful lot of money for the CEOs of some corporations. Is that a big factor nowadays?
I think there's no question that economics, financial gain are big factors for different players, different actors, depending on the scale of analysis that you're thinking about. But it also, I think, illustrates very clearly the complexities of these social settings where we find conflict, where we find warfare. Because there are many different participants. There are many different folks who are active participants, but also just they happen to be there and they're just trying to survive. So Mother Courage is a perfect example of this. This is the social environment in which she finds herself. But, and it's not through her own actions or her own decision making. There are others that are making these decisions that lead to these outcomes, these conditions. But I think when we think about the idea of profiteering, it raises the question for who benefits. What are those benefits? And that raises the question about motivations and why people participate. Are you forced to do so? Are you coerced into participating? Or do you just find yourself trying to survive? And when I think about my own family history, my father would describe to me in 1930s, 1940s, when he was growing up on the Korean Peninsula, there was the Japanese annexation of the peninsula. Once World War II comes to an end, the regimes change, the powers change, the faces come and go, but how these communities go on does not change. They're still just trying to survive. Just different people are in power. And there is conflict that comes in and out as a result of all that. In his mind, he didn't have any clues about the ideology, about communist ideology or anything like that. It didn't occur to him why people were coming and going. It was just a matter of what do we eat today? How do we survive? How do we help each other within our own community? But you can see how those kinds of geopolitical forces then have an effect. And so somebody is profiting for sure, but not everyone's aware of how that's happening, and not everyone has the power to do anything about it either.
Yeah, I think actually the people who are affected are the ones who really don't have any power, except, you know, very small choices like Mother Courage's choice to survive that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's get back to that in a minute. But Mark, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. Building on what Nam just said, I think it's very interesting in the Mother Courage play by Brecht that the complicity and the cowardice of the poor people, of the common people, is made very clear. Whether they win or lose, they don't have any chance in wartime. So Mother Courage is constantly changing her flag from a Protestant flag to a Catholic flag because that's how she's going to be able to fill her wagon with goods. But at the same time, you can see how she comes up with reasons time and again to criticize war, but yet she never herself draws the consequences from that. She loses each one of her children, but at the end of the play, she's still calling to the soldiers who are moving out, "Wait, take me with you. I want to go with you." So the actual existence of the common people here is really thrown into question on the part of Brecht, thrown into our lap as the audience to begin to think how we are reacting today. Gaza, Ukraine, Sudan, you name it. How come we're sitting here at a table just talking about it?
Right, yeah. And I must say, this is with me all day, every day. You know, I eat, I drink, I sleep, and I'm like, how can I do that while all this is going on? I don't know, does any of you want to comment on that? No, okay. So now I'm going back then to what's the history? What do we know about the profit motive in ancient times, in older wars? Was that always a motive or not really? To the degree that we know. I understand we don't have probably books about that.
Right. So I suppose we could start with a disclaimer that it's difficult, especially in certain archaeological settings, to know what people were thinking. If they didn't write anything down for us, even if they did, it would be difficult to interpret if that is actually what they meant, and does that represent everyone. That being said, the kinds of motives that people have hypothesized about run the gamut. I don't think that we can clearly say that war is always about profit for financial gain. It could very well be, but there are other kinds of motivations for why people fight. There are other kinds of motivations for why people consider other groups of people to be acceptable targets for forms of violence. And it's not always about financial gain. It's not always about territorial gain. It can be about beliefs as well. And this is something that I feel very strongly about. Our forms of conflict, if we compare ourselves to other species within the natural world, we do see organized violence in other species. It's not common, but we do see it. One of the very big differences, at least for me, as a stark contrast, is the ways in which we mediate our forms of violence with culture. We come up with ideas. We come up with rules, morals. We come up with feelings of obligation. If there is someone in my community that is attacked, I have to respond in kind. I have to protect not just the land that we live on, but the community or the bonds that I might have with this person. I might go into battle to protect someone who's a complete stranger to me, simply because we are under the same flag. Those are the kinds of ideals that we fight for. We don't see that in the natural world. So when I am faced with those kinds of observations, it tells me how important culture is, how important socialization is. We invent reasons and motives, and they're not always tied to economic gain.
Mm-hmm. But what that brings to me is also the notion of manipulation, right? That sometimes it's exactly like you say, my culture is this, your culture is that, I hate your culture, I'll go attack you. But often it is that my leader is telling me that you are bad, and I mean, your face is different than mine, yes. So I should go and annihilate you.
Yes.
And that again goes back to some kind of profit for the leaders, right? Not necessarily money,
right.
But often it's natural resources or something else. But so what do we know about that again?
Right. I don't discount that at all. I think that if again, it depends on who you're interviewing or who you're asking the question, why are you participating? But for some people, I think you're absolutely right. Ideology becomes a very important factor because it can be manipulated. So let's say, hypothetically, we want to convince ourselves that some cause is needed for us to engage in a very risky behavior, risking our lives, our health, but also inflicting violence and harm upon another group of people. We have to invent reasons and compel ourselves to do so. And that act itself can be manipulated. There are folks who can capitalize on that, who might decide there are several steps removed from now that results and outcomes that I need, but I have to manufacture these pathways to get there. And oftentimes that involves putting people into harm's way to get there.
Yeah, yeah. Let me reintroduce our guest, Nam Kim. You just heard him. He's associate professor of anthropology. He is a co-writer of Emergent Warfare in Our Evolutionary Past. We also have with us David Simmons, the founder and director of Fermat's Last Theater, and Mark Silberman, professor emeritus of German and Ebrecht. I'm trying to say it the way you say it. Is that pretty close? Brecht. Scholar who has translated and edited many works on Brecht and German culture. You're welcome to join us. We don't have a whole lot of time, but if you have relevant questions or comments, 608-256-2001, extension 1. You can join us on social media, at War Talk on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, or A Public Affair on Facebook. David, what are your thoughts as we keep discussing these issues?
Oh, well, it's important to understand how Mother Courage got her name. She drove her wagon through the bombardment of Riga with 30 loaves of bread, and she says that she had to sell them because they were going stale and she'd be ruined. And so that's where she gets the name Courage, from making a sale.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, the notion of courage, right? What is courage? Is it to be the one who goes ahead and kills the most people? Or is it the one who dares say, I'm not going to participate in that, whatever the consequences? Mark?
Esti, I think this has to do exactly with what Nam was talking about and what you mentioned as manipulation, propaganda. This play, Mother Courage, is all about virtues. What is a virtue at one time becomes a crime at another time, depending on whether you're at war or at peace. And there's a consistent line on Brecht's part in this play of understanding how virtues themselves are propaganda. They come in handy, like courage. What is courage? It's simply an agreement among a group of people of what's important.
Right, right. Nam.
Can I just riff on that for a second? The idea of courage, I totally agree. I think it is a very subjective idea. And there's, I don't know if folks are familiar with this story of a Japanese soldier at the end of World War II, Hiro Onoda, in the Philippines. So for those that might not be familiar, in a nutshell, we know that this individual at the end of the war and some of his colleagues, other fellow soldiers, they remain in the Philippines after the war ends. Despite the fact that leaflets were dropped and they were being informed in some ways that the war was over, they remain and they keep persisting in fighting. And in his case, for I think something like 28 years, neither surrendering nor committing suicide or anything like that. And one would ask, is this courage? Is this duty? Is it obligation?
Is it heroism?
Is it heroism? Is it insanity?
Stupidity.
Stupidity. There are all kinds of questions, and it depends on one's perspective, right? And it has to do with the cultural mediation of these actions and the belief systems that one has. I think even in Japan, there were debates about when he came home, and it's a very interesting story how he comes home, but when he comes home, there were debates about, is this the best of our culture, or maybe is it the worst representation of mm-hmm. how we expect people to behave this way?
Well, and speaking of Japan, the custom of harakiri, right? If you can explain to people what that is. But again, people are killing themselves to support the leader, leaving families without breadwinners and so on and so forth. If you want to talk about that,
yeah.
too.
I mean, I don't have much to say about it, except that I think it does powerfully illustrate once again for us the power of culture and belief.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
one can think of forms of sacrifice as part of the greater good. So perhaps this is a sacrifice I might make individually that my family is obligated to make as well. Despite their loss of me, we are all making a collective sacrifice. That's one perspective. Or we might have the opposite perspective about the loss itself. Taking away someone from the family.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you use the word obligation, right? How do people even come to believe that they're obliged to sacrifice themselves for something that they really have no personal interest in? I don't know who of you would like to respond to that.
It speaks to the need, I think, for the powers that be to dehumanize the other side, and that's an important factor in our cultural indoctrination or education, however you want to phrase it. But the other needs to be demonized in order for people to screw up their courage and go to war.
Yeah. So we are currently at a really existential point for humanity and all other species on Earth, or most of them anyway. Climate change, degradation, pollution. We might not see, or, you know, we won't see, but I don't know what kind of life our grandchildren would have, or their children. And war is a big part of that, right? War is such a polluter and such a user of fossil fuels. So let me start with you, Nam. Do we have historical, archaeological proof of degradation of the environment in the far past because of war? What do we know about that?
Maybe not in the scale that we see today, in terms of the impact on our climates, for instance. However, in terms of social impact, it's clear. The impact on societies, on whole communities, on cities of the past, we can see the scourge of war having massive impact and changing the course of history for many people. If one were to contemplate how many different societies existed in the archaeological past, how many different ethnicities, languages, and so forth, some of it transforms and morphs into something else, but a lot of it probably goes away as a result of having been targeted by other people as well.
Yeah.
So from that standpoint, we could say maybe today we have the greater capacity, technological capacity, to destroy, but we still had that capacity in the past in different ways. And I'm thinking about, for example, archaeological cases from some of the earliest farming communities in Europe, the linear band ceramic, for instance, linear pottery culture. We're talking about before the existence of cities, before the existence of so-called civilizations or states, and they date to something like 7,000 to 8,000 years ago. And for the longest time, the LBK, that's the short acronym for this culture, were held up as this very quintessential model of peaceful agrarian farming villages in Europe. Until in the 90s or so, people started to look more closely at some of their settlements and realized, oh, they're actually building ditches around their villages. And just on the inside of these ditches, we can see the remnants of palisade walls. They were fortifying their villages. They were protecting themselves from something. Mm-hmm. And then we started to realize, more and more research coming out of different places in Germany and Belgium and elsewhere, that we actually see signs of massacre with entire villages, every demographic you can think of represented in this, not just those that might be professional warriors or soldiers, but everyone being involved in some way and sometimes being massacred. If we think about it from that perspective, our society, especially in the United States, we're buffered. We have plenty of people. We're not all engaged in conflict on the front lines. We're not affected directly on a day-to-day basis. But if you were to live in a smaller scale society, a village like this, and war comes to your door, it is quite significant. So maybe the destruction, the level of destruction for the globe is very different today, the capacity, but in the past it was very significant for people.
Yeah. So what you just said, I think, might explain, at least to some degree, the need, it seems, that even huge empires like the United States or Russia to always be secure and safe, because there's always someone, an enemy at the door.
That's one
maybe,
perspective.
Maybe not.
Sure?
Yeah.
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 I mean, I started off as an international relations student and studied war from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I found curious about the perspective was that war was almost inevitable because of the nature of the state system, which kind of drove me away from political science and IR theory, because then I started to ask, well, what are the reasons why, the cultural reasons why people fight? And that,
yeah.
that is what drew me to anthropology and archaeology as I started to ask these questions about the deeper past.
Okay, so we have so little time left. I want to get from each of you like a minute to a minute and a half of the future, right? I mean, my question is, can we stop war? Can we avoid war? Sounds pretty ridiculous right now, but really, if we don't, I think we're doomed. So that's one question, but if you have other thoughts, you're welcome to share them. Mark, why don't we start with you?
Esty, I'd just like to come back to your question about climate change, about the future of the war, the participation of war in the kinds of future climate that we're dealing with. We don't have to go back into archaeology. You can think of the atomic bomb and the development of the atomic bomb. It wasn't just bombs that were dropped on Japan, two cities. We have all the fallout. We have the tests. We have the post-tests. It's in the soil. It's in our food chain. It's in the oceans. So that's something we're going to be living with for quite a long time, the half-life of radioactivity.
Yeah, so the way we punish others, we punish ourselves too,
yes,
among
exactly.
other things. Yeah, yeah. David?
The thing that I find interesting is the one actor in the U.S. state that takes climate change the most seriously is probably the military, because they can see that there are going to be wars over resources in the very near future, I'm afraid.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Which is very interesting. And Nam, you have a little talk because other two have been brief.
Thank you. So as bleak as it seems, I do harbor some measure or modicum of hope for our future, simply because if the premise that I subscribe to is correct and we have choices, and a lot of it is culturally mediated, we can start to change our cultural perceptions about what is acceptable and what is unacceptable. And that might not lead to wholesale changes in the eradication of war, but it might minimize or decrease the likelihood that we choose certain pathways when we are faced with certain conditions. And I'll end by with one very simple anecdote. If we look at other primates, for instance, a lot of people hold up chimpanzees as this example of, well, if chimpanzees participate in organized violence, and they're very, very good at it, especially the males, it's quite plausible that our ancestors were like that, and hence we've evolved to be this way. But I also know about other primate stories. There was a story from Africa of baboon troops in the 1980s. I don't know if folks are familiar with this, but in this particular area, there were two different troops. The one was called the forest troop. One was called the garbage dump troop. The garbage dump troop was called that because they would congregate around this garbage pit and forage for food. A lot of the aggressive males would participate in this. There was a tuberculosis outbreak, and most of those aggressive males end up dying. The ones that remained were very young. They weren't very aggressive. They go back to the forest troop, and the atmosphere changes within a generation. Mm. Rather than competition, rather than a lot of violent behavior, we see a very relaxed atmosphere. And not only that, but in subsequent generations, when new males come into that troop, the females and the other males that were in that culture, quote-unquote culture, started to transmit that kind of norm. They encouraged certain kinds of behavior and discouraged others. My point here is that we can learn to
we can do
things.
It. Yeah,
we can.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why we need art.
And art certainly is very important in that. David, when is Mother Courage or Courage shown?
The first show is tonight at 7:30 at the Art and Lit Lab, and then Saturday and Sunday there are 2 p.m. matinees.
Okay, well, David Simmons, Mark Silberman, Nam Kim, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate this conversation. And thanks to Jade, of course, and Summer, of course. Stay tuned. The Funny Boys are at, where? At one of the venues of the film festival. Should be fun. Bye-bye.
You're listening to WORT Madison.
Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got you. Wow, I feel good now. The sugar runs by. I feel nice. The sugar runs by.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Melon. Whoa. These are hot mics.
Hot mics.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Ooh, here we go. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. And I'm Mel, and back from assignment for one day today is Floyd.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. So, of course, here today, of course, is being the lobby of the Bartell Theater at 113 East Mifflin Street. We're streaming remotely during the Wisconsin Film Festival, which kicked off last night.
They've got us placed strategically between the restroom and the bar, so I think we'll be okay.
It's the circle of life.
It is.
So, Floyd, we have a script.
We have a producer. We have two engineers, three engineers, one back at the station.